Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Thomas Lynch has been a funeral director in Milford, Michigan since 1974. But he's better known for his poetry and essays, which are often inspired by his profession. His book, The Undertaking, was the basis of an episode of Frontline on PBS and a BBC documentary. Thomas's most recent book is Whence and Whither, On Lives and Living. And a new book, The Depositions, is coming out in November 2019. Thomas visited Traverse City in 2010 and talked with author Jerry Dennis on the stage of the City Opera House. At that time, Thomas's book, Apparition and Late Fictions, had recently been published. Jerry started out the evening reading from one of his favorite early poems by Thomas Lynch.
It's titled, For the Ex-Wife on the Occasion of Her Birthday. I would like to read the first stanza. Let me say outright that I bear you no unusual malice anymore, nor do I wish for you tumors or loose stools, blood in your urine, oozings from any orifice. The list is endless of those ills I do not pray befall you. Night sweats, occasional itching, PMS, fits, starts, tics, boils, bad vibes, vaginal odors, emotional upheavals, or hormonal disorders. And it goes on like that for two pages. And though I do not have an ex-wife and do not wish to have one, I thought, this is a poet with a rare gift. Not only can he sling insults with uncommon grace and wit, but he has the quality, perhaps the rarest quality in any writer, of precise and daring judgment, of balance, of knowing exactly how far to go and not an inch further. An expert on the gravest subject of all, and yet he is always laughing. Please welcome Thomas Lynch.
Thanks so much for that.
I wonder, you are one of the busiest writers I know. You travel around the world to speak and to read your work. You consult on television projects. You teach. You fit a lot in, into your schedule. And you run the or help run the family business. And yet your production has been not only prolific, but of uniformly high quality. What is your writing, your typical writing day like, if there is a typical one? And if there isn't, what's your ideal?
Mm-hmm. Well, my typical day is that I rise very early, and this is a habit I've been in for the longest time. The quiet time, I was a single parent for 7 years, and I noticed that the hours like between 5 and 7 were usually safe from any interruption, so they became the hours that I would work in. As far as the perfect day, I think for me, it's always a Sunday afternoon with my grandmothers. It was my father's habit to bring them home. They were widowed women, both from Michigan women, but they were widowed for most of my young life and into my adulthood. And he would bring them home after Mass on Sunday and get them liquored up, and always set them arguing about religion or sex or politics, whatever the priest hadn't covered. And I would say to him, why do you do this? And he'd say, well, you keep your ears open, you'll learn more from those contentious women than you'll ever learn at school. And he was right, because they were opposites, Jerry. My mother's mother was from the Upper Peninsula, and she came down to Ann Arbor to go to school to study music. She was gifted with that, and her name was Marvel Grace O'Hara. And Marvel Grace was her maiden name. She met Pat O'Hara, who played in the marching band, and was smitten by the evidence of photographs by her ankles, apparently. It's the only thing that ever appears in the uncovered. And I often wondered how these people made babies, you know, when you look at those 19th century photographs. But She was a rabid Republican, a union organizer. She taught music in the Detroit schools forever and did everything in the idolatrous style of the Irish Catholic. And I think I was her favorite. Whereas my father's mother was this quiet Methodist woman. She had Dutch relations, and she wore her hair in a bun, wore sensible shoes, print dresses, made wonderful stews and cookies and things, and never did anything outlandish or out of sorts. She was an Eisenhower Republican who, I think, voted for him into the 1980s. And the only scandalous thing she ever did was that she fell in love with an Irish Catholic in the 1920s, and it wasn't good news for her Methodist people. Because she had to, as was the style of the day, convert to what she would ever after call the one true faith, Tom, appending this lilt that sounded like a question mark. Yeah. And she would explain the experience to me, saying, the priest splashed a little water on me, Tom, and said, Geraldine, you were born a Methodist and raised a Methodist. Thanks be to God, now you're Catholic.
Every time.
Every time. Some weeks after the eventual nuptials, she was out in the backyard grilling steaks for my grandfather on the first Friday in Lent when one of the... the conversion hadn't taken entirely. And one of the brother knights from the KFC leapt over the back fence to scold her for the smell of beef rising over a Catholic household in the holy season. And she nodded and smiled and listened to your man and then walked over to the garden hose and splashed water on the grill and said, you were born cows, raised cows. Thanks be to God, now you're fish. But it was my first, and she would say, Tom, we're all the same but different, all God's children. Then there were all these lessons in there, pronouncements, you know. But I thought, that authority, the ability to actually change cows to fish by pronouncement struck me as great magic and great medicine. And I thought, I want to do that. I want language that can reshape and remake and renew. And so whenever I don't have a day that I sit down that I'm not trying to replicate these two contentious widowed women arguing over sex or death or politics or religion, you know? And some days I get a good dose of it, and some days it's more elusive.
As a child, were you a storyteller? Did they listen to your pronouncements as well?
I don't know. I love the sort of the noise of the language. I didn't really care so much about the stories or the outcomes. I love the way syllables rubbed up against one another. And I love the sort of magical language that was part of, you know, my childhood. I mean, I had a nunnish upbringing, so I was taught to say prayers that rhymed, you know. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here. And I didn't understand the sort of grim little logic of that. I could take it up with Oprah, but all I liked was the way that dear and here sort of had this acoustic kinship. And it was much the same next door where they were saying, God is great, God is good, let us thank him for this food. You know, it was the mm-hmm. sort of Protestant version of a grace before meals. Mm-hmm. And this meter in rhyme, this memorable sounding language began to become, you know, I mean, everything I learned started with A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, now I lay me down to sleep. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, tiger, tiger, burning bright. Irish poets, learn your trade, sing. It's the same trochee, trochee, falling thus. Mm. Grief and meter order us. Mm. So it's the acoustic seduction of language was for me more important than the sort of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and this mm-hmm. happened.
Maybe this is a question for university literary critics. And if it bores you, tell me. But in Still Life in Milford and in your forthcoming collection, Walking Papers, you have a remarkable series of poems featuring Argyle the Sin Eater.
Right.
Would you talk a little about the role that Irish folklore and Catholic tradition as well have always played in your work, and what role Ireland and the Irish play as well?
Well, ethnicity and religion, I think, in everyone's life plays a great... They inform identity in a way that is unlike any other because you can't hide from it, even though you can become devoutly lapsed or a disbeliever. I often quote friends from Belfast who'd be asked about, you know, are you Protestant or Catholic? And they'd say, well, we're atheists. And they'd say, yes, but are you Protestant or Catholic atheists? Because ethnicity imprints in ways that are hard to undo. And I was contracted by my editors to write a book about Ireland, you know, after Angela's Ashes did so well. They thought, well, Lynch can write an Irish book, and they paid me a fat advance to do just that. And then, but that I made the contract in the summer of 2001, and by September of 2001, the idea of tribe and race and sect and religious identity had taken on a very sharp double-edgedness. Do you know? So the book became for me an examination of those identities, and it became much less the sort of jaunty travelogue the publishers wanted, but I thought, from my perspective, it was much more a learning experience to write. And but Argyll is, there was a paragraph that appeared in an early history of funeral service that I read. It's called The History of American Funeral Directing. Probably you won't have read it, many of you. Dan Yonkoff has read it, and Peg has probably insisted that he read it again, and their daughter has lately read it. But there's this one paragraph about this functionary at funerals who was brought in mostly in Wales and Scotland and Ireland, and they'd lay the corpse out in front of him, and they would present him with a loaf of bread and a bowl of beer, and by consuming those things, he was taking unto himself the purgatory, the recompense that the corpse owed to whomever's in charge here. So it was a kind of secular priesthood because he was taking evil in the form of bread and beer rather than presenting goodness in the form of bread and wine. Mm. And so they were often at odds with the reverend clergy of the day. And it occurred to me that the people had this huge ambivalence about them because they wanted them to be around when they needed them in bad times. Mm-hmm. They hated the fact that they had to pay them for the service. And it was not a whole lot unlike funeral directors or poets. Yes. Because we, you know, we like poetry. We like to have it in the same, we like good, clean drinking water, good roads, proper toilets and things like that. As long as we don't have to read any poems, you know. We like him, you know, and it's much the same with funeral directors, you know. My father used to say, better to know us and not need us than to need us and not know us. So you'd know he had time on his hands to think those things up.
Yeah. Well, you have written powerfully and beautifully about, and this is not a pun, I know, about the gravest of subjects. And yet, that humor, like in your gift of a poem to your ex-wife, with that nice scalpel-like edge to it, which I love so much. Why humor? What makes you laugh, and why are you laughing so much in your work?
Well, you know the answer to this question because I see
I'm in your own work. Yeah,
it's because, as my grandmother used to say, that the ridiculous and the sublime belly up to the same bar, that the good laugh and the good cry, the wince and the grin, require exactly the same muscles, you know? That the things that most distress us, if we just stand back, the same intake of air can come out in a good laugh, you know? So I didn't invent that. I mean, whomever invented humanity invented this appetite for the good laugh and the good cry. And I just love assembling circumstances in which they can appear at the same time, or when people don't know exactly what they ought to do. I've always said, you know, a very good wedding is one at which people are weeping for no apparent reason, and a good funeral is the one at which people are laughing for no apparent reason, you know. But good events are ones, I think, that invite the whole emotional register, and good writing should do some of that, you know.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Thomas Lynch reads from his book, Apparition and Late Fictions.
listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Jerry Dennis's conversation with Thomas Lynch.
Is this a good time to read?
I'd be happy to read a bit from all. There's five stories in this book. Four of them take place in Michigan. And probably I owe as much to you, Jerry, for making me feel like a Michigan resident, a Michigan citizen, because the way you've written with such reverence about our place, you know, and I think for current and future generations, they will learn how it is to, why Michigan is different because of reading Jerry Dennis. And so for me, writing about rivers and lakes and, you know, fishing and abandoned rail easements and stuff like that, it comes from the same kind of reverence that you've brought to the notion of being on this peninsula. One story, the longest one, takes place in Ohio, or is, you know, is situated in Ohio. It's about a lapsed Methodist clergyman, or as a Presbyterian pastor said to me, isn't that redundant? But they all get the dig in,
they, you know.
But the clergy have been such heroes of mine because, you know, usually between the corpse and the living people to whom the death matters, there's some brave soul who turns up in the middle of them to broker a peace between them, to say something like, behold, I show you a mystery. I think it takes real courage. Yeah, I think it risks looking ridiculous in order to be sublime. And so writing about the clergy was something I wanted to do. I'm going to read three little sections from this story because it's the longest one in the book. And if, as publishers tell me, you buy the book but don't read it, which is okay with writers, you know, at least you know parts of it. So here, I think I'd like to introduce the character of Adrian Littlefield, this Methodist minister. This is the first couple paragraphs of the story. The story is called Apparition, which, of course, is a ghostly appearance, or in Catholic theology, it always involves the appearance of the Blessed Mother. And she may appear in, you know, rutabagas or on the walls of a mall or something, but whenever she appears, it's an apparition. It was good riddance that put Adrian Littlefield on the lecture circuit. Before riddance, he'd self-published two pastel-covered self-help books with fashionably gerundive titles, Learning to Love in the Present Tense and Making the Best of Worst-Case Scenarios. They were widely ignored and only sold to his family and folks at the church where he was the assistant pastor in those early years of marriage and parenthood. He'd done a workbook on dividing family duties between spouses and written a couple of articles for the ministerial press, but otherwise was going nowhere and barely making ends meet until after Claire left him, he wrote Good Riddance, Divorcing for Keeps, and it changed his life. It held that some divorces, like some marriages, are made in heaven, and we ought to be thankful for them. The key to living in concert with God's will or the natural order or what the fates had in mind for you was to learn to accept the direction your love life was taking you, even when it meant the end of love. Divorce was neither the result of too much of one thing nor too little of another, too many heartbreaks or too few. It was like tsunamis and famines, hurricanes and genocides, God's way of culling humanity's herd of lovers for reasons that were unknowable to mortals, but part, nonetheless, of a larger plan. It happens, Adrian Littlefield told his readers unambiguously. We must go with the flow. That's life. Get over it. Get on with it. It took him 6 months to write it, a month to get an agent, and another month to get a contract and fat advance from a publisher in New York. It was an immediate hit. The first printing sold out in a week. The paperback rights went for $500,000. There was talk of a documentary for one of the cable networks. The invitations followed. He worked up a little 40-minute shtick for the keynotes and workshops. He could bend his presentation, peppered with tastefully suggestive humor, around the occupational curiosity of any professional association. He had an infomercial in post-production, one of those hour-long specials where he wore baggy clothes and did a little chalk talk with a really attractive and earnest-looking studio audience. He traveled 3 months out of every four from his home office in Findlay, Ohio, where he housed, behind his sprawling Queen Anne Mansion on the corner of South Main and Second Streets in a carriage house he'd refurbished with money from his books and lectures, the Center for Postmarital Studies, an elaborate tax shelter, along with the foundation that raised funds to advance the work of the CPMS, which was primarily to pay its principal apostle himself to spread the word such as it was revealed to him. He'd kept pace with the rapidly expanding technologies, from blast fax to email and website, and some nights posting the latest news to his site or linking a recent interview so his followers could listen in, he felt not a little like Paul writing epistles to the various churches. If, as that great circuit rider wrote, it is better to marry than to burn, was it not much better still to divorce than to smolder? X's, Adrian's favorite slogan held, you can't live with him and you can't shoot him. A little good riddance goes a long way. So it goes on to detail his rise to fame and fortune. But because the story is a longish one, a novella, he has to review the occasions that brought him to this precipice. So he reviews the dissolution of his marriage. His wife runs off with a video film documentarian from the community college in Findlay. She runs off with him, his name is David Eason, to Cincinnati, ostensibly to film the last ferry boat crossing the Ohio in that town. But they end up in a hotel. And of course, Adrian has by this time had her followed because he assumes the worst is going to happen and he has to go to court, et cetera, et cetera. What really convinces him that the marriage is over is of pictures taken of the new lovebirds at Mount Adams, one of the hills overlooking the city and the Ohio Valley over the river. And this is where he had proposed marriage to his wife, Claire. And the fact that she would share this intimate space with a new lover was more of a betrayal than even the sex. So we pick up just as he's coming to these conclusions. That she would share their places with someone else seemed a more intimate betrayal than even sex. He called the attorney. He wept, giving their particulars, full names, birth dates, date of marriage. The papers would be filed in the morning. She was served as she left her class with David on Monday night. Adrian had left on Sunday afternoon and taken the children to visit his parents in Grand Rapids. He left a manila envelope on their bed with photos of her and David coming and going from their assorted rendezvous and a note that told her he had chapter and verse on her film project and would use them against her if she contested anything. It would be a slam dunk, he told her. She was to move out now. He underlined the word now. In the end, of course, she moved out not because of his threats, but because of himself and the dull life with him she no longer wanted and could no longer endure. She moved out because that's exactly what she wanted to do, and Claire could be counted on to do what she wanted. When Adrian and Damien and Sarah came home that Tuesday in the middle of June to the house they had all shared on the corner of South Corey Street and Lima Avenue, Claire and her things were unmistakably gone. She had moved out into an apartment on the other side of Findlay. She told the children she would always love them and would be coming back for them as soon as she got herself established. Everything is going to be really terrific, she told them. You're going to love New York. There's so much to see and do there. Not like, finally, Ohio. Wait and see. She'd come back for the last bits and pieces of her things. The white Toyota van was idling at the curb with the back doors open for Claire to pitch garbage bags full of her clothes and linens in. They kept nodding and smiling and weeping and hugging her, their little hands and faces holding and searching and wondering why this was all happening and why couldn't she stay with them and be their mother, and she would always be their mother no matter what, and someday she was sure they'd understand, and Adrian went into the house and vomited because he felt so helpless, so totally lost in the tears of things, so angry and heart-rent and utterly helpless, and their mother's voice trailing off as she left them on the porch, waving and sobbing, and jumped into the van with her lover and drove off into the future. Adrian stood looking out the screen door at the small figures of his children on the porch. All of this happening in slow motion now as the van disembarked and they raised their little hands and waved and waved and waved. No remembrance of these events was free of the guilt Adrian still felt for the damage done his son and daughter, his complicity in its infliction. Now what he could remember was the creak of the spring on the screen door as he pushed it open and held it open and said, "Come in now," and how the two of them turned, limp from the waving and weeping, and how Damien took his sister Sarah's hand and brought her back inside their suddenly and terribly broken home. This was the moment, these many years since, that Adrian Littlefield could never forgive himself for failing his darling son and precious daughter so profoundly, for doing them such unspeakable damage by failing to keep their mother home, the marriage together, the household intact, life as they had come to know it safe and warm and blessed with abundant love. He couldn't protect his children from this hurt. His wife, their mother, had just driven off with her new lover in a white van, leaving them all fixed and wriggling in the here and now without a clue as to what the future would hold. And as much as his heart hurt for his children's damage, standing at the kitchen counter buttering bread to make them grilled cheese sandwiches and pouring out three matching glasses of milk and cutting up a green apple into six little wedges and placing this meal before them and holding their tiny hands saying, "Let us pray," and hearing their little voices give out with the accustomed grace to it, "God is great, God is good," some corner of his broken, brooding heart quickened with the hope that his own life and times might just have gotten better, easier, simpler, saner somehow. "Good riddance," he did not say out loud while they ate their sandwiches wordlessly, but he said it nonetheless. "Good riddance, indeed." So he is, of course, he becomes a sort of embarrassment to the local Methodists because, you know, this is untidy for a clergyman to have a wife take off to Cincinnati with a filmmaker. So, and the other Christians in the community, the reverend clergy among them, sort of avoid him because they think that marital unrest is contagious. And so they pray for him, but they avoid him. Except for one, a priest from St. Michael the Archangel's Parish in Findlay, Father Francis X. Con Cannon, who begins to come over bringing controlled substances and books of poetry, and he helps him with the laundry, and babysits sometimes, and tries to get Adrian out of the depression he seems to be in. Eventually, he decides that Adrian really has to get out of the house, and he convinces him that he has to go on a road trip with him. So he brings over, the priest brings over the fourth grade teacher from the parochial school and installs her as the babysitter. Her name is Mary DiDona, and kidnaps Adrian and takes him on a road trip up I-75 to Windsor, Ontario, for what he calls the Windsor Ballet. On the way there, the priest is getting high on very good marijuana, and Adrian catches a contact high of some sort, and then he takes him to an Italian restaurant where he drinks too much wine, and then they go to this ballet that involves naked women walking on tops of bars around and around, and Adrian is taken with this, and on the way home, he passes out from the excesses of the evening, and the priest literally pours him into his bed, and the babysitter stays, and the priest leaves, pronouncing a benediction on the whole adventure, and the next morning, Adrian has to preach it Sunday morning, and he preaches every other Sunday, and for some reason, his preaching has taken a different turn. I'll pick it up there, and this will just take a minute. The Reverend Adrian Littlefield, recently quit by his adulterous wife, recently angry and lonely and bone-tired of the duties of single parenting, recently despairing, recently at wit's end over his prospects, recently drunk, recently stoned, recently a patron of a topless, bottomless bar in Windsor, only a matter of hours after having sex with his children's babysitter, whose first name he could remember but whose surname had escaped him, had stood in the sanctuary under the massive stained-glass likeness of Christ as Lord and before the faithful congregation of St. Mark's United Methodist on South Main Street in Findlay, and uncharacteristically lost for words, cleared his throat opened his arms as Moses before the Red Sea and raising his inexplicably grinning face heavenward, instead of commencing a sermon, sang out, off-key but enthusiastically, in evident praise and thanksgiving for all of his recent iniquities. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. He stepped from behind the oaken pulpit, stationed himself in the front of the altar, and smiling widely, raised his voice again. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be, and he was well into the next verse, though he wasn't entirely sure he knew it, and when the night is cloudy, there is still a light that, and might have even made some sense of all of it, but the Reverend Dr. Hingston, his senior pastor, sensing something in his associate's manner was terribly amiss and worried that the 11 o'clock service was about to go seriously off track, rose from his seat behind the pulpit and led the people in polite applause. Then, wordlessly, by nod and glaring, signaled the ushers at the back of church to pass the plates for the offering, please. A couple of spiky-haired teens dressed in black and emblazoned with tattoos and seated with their perpetually embarrassed parents arose during Adrian's brief solo and, thrusting their fists into the air, took up the chorus. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. While one air keyboarded the piano chords and the other air guitared the heavy bass notes of the refrain, all the while nodding their spiky heads furiously in time. Marilyn Rubritis, the unmarried and, it was rumored, heavily medicated daughter of the long widow Geraldine Rubritis, stood in the middle of the pew she and her mother had occupied quietly for nearly half of a century, unknotted her long silver hair from the bun it had been in all of her life till it fell in quick, luxuriant waves over the red cashmere sweater she always wore to church, and began to sway with the singing rhythmically, her arms outreaching and her palms upturned, her bony shoulders and skinny hips achieving a kind of tidal sway, and the look on her face one of ecstasy, the way you'd imagine young hippie girls at Woodstock years before. Cleta Losi, the organist, never one to be caught off guard, had taken up the tune, which of course she knew, while the Reverend Hingston tried from his side of the sanctuary to eyeball her to quit, and the ushers moved with the gilded plates up the aisles, and everyone, reaching for their tithes and offerings, looked back and forth at one another, wondering what it was they had just suddenly witnessed. It had lasted only a couple of minutes, but it was sufficiently outside the pale of their erstwhile church experiences that they knew something unforeseen and unplanned had happened. Did you see them? Whispered Adrian, still grinning like a simpleton. The heavenly hosts, as Reverend Hingston led him to the vestry, while the bell choir, after a series of dagger looks from the senior pastor and accustomed to playing for time, took up their rendition of How Great Thou Art. After removing his stole and cincture and robe and following the Reverend Hingston's directive, Adrian collected his children from their Sunday school classes, loaded them into the family Honda, and drove them home. He sang all the way home. Because he could not keep from grinning, Damien and Sarah grinned back at him. For the first time in months, they all looked joyous. I tell you, Francis, it was the closest thing to inspiration I ever felt. The breath of God. As if I'd been suddenly loosed from the bonds of gravity and routine. Always before Francis, I'd be trying to say something that had touched their souls while they'd all be trying not to fall asleep, but this was different. I tell you, Francis, I felt alive, and they looked alive to me. For the first time, I looked out over that little sea of faces and saw them all as fellow pilgrims. Not fellow United Methodist or fellow Christians or fellow sinners, just fellow humans in search of a way home. And I could see that what they didn't need from me was another sermon. It's as if I could see myself in them, hapless and lonely, holy and free. All of us somehow in it together, Francis, just trying to find our way home, wondering if we're going to make it. The priest nodded and smiled and sipped his tea while Adrian carried on. It was an apparition. They looked like innocents, Francis, angels, every one of them. I tell you, I could see their wings. I could see them readying to take their flight. Cora Perkins, Fat Bill Wapner, the Grievous Fielding couple with their punk rock twins, they all just look so lovely to me, these people whose people I've been burying and marrying and baptizing. Poor Marilyn Rubritus, old Henry Richardson in his wingtips and banker suit, Art Geyer with his homely wife, the Morris sisters just turned 14 and 15, so proud of their new figures, the way boys are suddenly watching them now, Frida Chambers with her goiter and bug eyes. They all looked like cherubim and seraphim and archangels, and all I wanted to tell them, Francis, was that everything is going to be all right. Everything would turn out fine. I could see it all, Francis. They'd all be just fine and flying again. A beatific vision, Father Francis said. Was that some dope or what? It wasn't the dope, Francis, Adrian said. I think it started after Mary. What's her name? The priest sat up in the wing back, set his mug on the table, and leaned into the Mary Didona. What about her? Well, she came to me in the night. There was this dream, and I just woke up, and she was there. There? Well, she was on top of me, and she was naked, and, well, a beatific vision, Father Concannon said, sitting back, pressing his head into the high back of the chair, smiling broadly. Adrian looked puzzled. A pastoral visit. The priest was evidently not surprised. God bless her. Now there's a woman with really priestly instincts. Thanks.
Thanks. Very good.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Jerry Dennis's conversation with Thomas Lynch.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Jerry Dennis's conversation with Thomas Lynch.
I love when poets turn to prose.
Committing fiction, one reviewer called it.
Committing fiction.
Yeah.
Was it, to write it, was it like the weights had been lifted from your ankles and you began running and then took flight?
Well, there's some of that, Jerry. As you well know yourself, it's... Sentences are very fun and freeing events. I mean, you can go so many directions with them. But I do think, I mean, at least for me, poetry is still the thing without which nothing else happens. Mm-hmm. If I don't read poetry, occasionally have a go at writing it, then prose doesn't tune itself properly. I do think of poetry as like the tuning fork for the language, you know? So I think it's good exercise in the way that sit-ups are required for marathon runners, yeah. About which I know almost nothing. but I do think it's the same type of thing.
Well, Mary Oliver wrote something that I've never forgotten when she was discussing the difference between poetry and prose. And as you know, she writes both. She writes beautiful. She's known for, famous for her poetry, the reversal of most writers' situation. But she writes beautiful, evocative nature essays as well. And she said prose is earned, poetry is given. Mm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, poetry is work too, but yeah, I think we earn them both. I think poetry feels like word play. But I take Mary Oliver's meaning. I think you're right to quote her.
Okay. Can we change gears a little bit?
Sure. Maybe we should turn it open to...
how are we doing with
time? I think we're... Yeah, we probably should. We're getting tired of the sounds of our voices, I think.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should hear some others.
So, okay, great. Let's open it up to questions.
If there are no questions, Jerry and I have the 2.5-hour reading. Just waiting for the right audience. You qualify. So if there are questions, now would be the time to relieve us of the obligation to read at you some more. So, yeah.
Hi, I have a question. You write in all different types of genres, and I'm wondering how is it that each kind of impulse for things that you're writing, are you aware of when you get the idea, or does it come to you as you're writing it? Does it change sometimes from poetry to nonfiction to prose? How does it?
I think I'm speaking for Jerry here when I say I just, you know, writers only get a couple good ideas, so they just keep reusing them over and over again. So my idea is to write the poem, then the essay, then the story, then hope there's a movie version of it later on, based on the play that eventually will follow. But in general, poems tend to present themselves in big blasts of acoustics. You get a line, you know, for the longest time, our old dog long into its dotage yawns. Do you know the way those vowels kept opening towards the eventual yawn at the end of that line? I knew that that was going to be a poem eventually. It took years to make the second line, which triggered the whole rest of the poem. But there was an acoustic impulse. To me, there's an acoustic impulse to poetry, or a flash of an image. Or perhaps the Dairy Queen opens and they pay you to write a sonnet about it, you know. But essays are basically a reenactment of old conversations, old contentions between this and that. And it's usually not good and evil. It's usually between gratitude and begrudgery, you know, between the hateful word and just taking the garbage out and keeping your mouth shut. Essaying helps you sort that out.
I can't let you go without talking about 6 Feet Under. It's one of my favorite programs, and the way they approach death on that show, I'm so curious about your role in that. Was it a technical role? Was it a creative role?
Well, it's very kind of you to think of me as having a role at all in it, because Alan Ball, the creator of that marvelous series, was generous in saying that two of my books that had been published about the time he was working on that were instrumental in setting the tone for the show, and he made all his actors and writers and producers read it. And we had this correspondence going on for most of the time that that show was on the air. In fact, and he'd always invite Mary and me to the premieres every season, but you know, what with the vagaries of air travel, we said we won't bother. But he said this thing in an email once I'll never forget. He said, "Lynch, I finally figured out the formula for the program. Once you put a dead guy in the room, you can talk about anything." He said, "Of course, you've known that all along, you know, because it is what a wake is. You know, what we used to call a good funeral always involved the living assembling around a corpse, a thing that our species had done for more or less 40,000 years. Like before, depending on which channel you watch, it could have been 50,000 years, but the thing that separated humans from every other living, breathing thing that died is that they seemed to get mortality and pause at it and consign their dead to oblivions of their own choosing, the fire, the sea, the tomb, the grave. But they always had this pause where the dead and the living would be together and someone would be brought in to broker the sort of signature piece between them by saying something like, 'Behold, I show you a mystery.' Priest, rabbi, shaman, imam, poobah, witch, wizard, whoever, somebody crazy enough to try to make sense of this unspeakable thing. We did a program together, Alan Ball, and out at Los Angeles, we did a program that was called Once You Put a Dead Guy in the Room, You Can Talk About Anything. And I just thought it was a wonderful thing he did. I would like to see, really, I think as the first generation, maybe the first two generations of people who have been trying to do funerals without the dead guy in the room, I think we do that at our peril, you know. We keep organizing these celebrations of life, I think we're calling them now, you know, where the finger food is good and the talk is uplifting and the music is life-affirming and someone is on hand to proclaim closure just before the Merlot runs out. And everybody's welcome but the corpse who's been disappeared. And I think it's like having a wedding without the bride there. It just makes no sense to me ritually. I think we've gone very much ritually astray. And we don't need boxes and mum plants and bagpipers and dove releases. You don't need funeral directors and you don't need, but you do need a corpse. That's sort of essential. Somebody who agrees to quit breathing forever should be there, They really are the star, And by the way, if we're going to burn our dead, I think we ought to go see the fire. Because it is as purely gifted to us as the ground is. It is purifying, warming, illuminating, full of warmth. And I've never had a family go to a retort or crematory with me that didn't thank me afterwards for encouraging them to do so. And these are not places that are housed in, the commemorative theme parks like cemeteries. They are in industrial parks. But it is where they keep the fire. So if we, we should go the distance with our dead.
Right here, let's in the back.
You seem to launch a lot of humor from subjects and situations where a lot of us find it hard to get at the humor, but I enjoy your point of view. And I was going to ask your marital status, but you did mention a wife. I just wondered if it's particularly cathartic, your poem about wishing no ill on your ex-wife on the occasion of her birthday, that was hilarious, and things like that. It must be particularly cathartic to be able to write about things like that, and I wondered how your wife takes it.
Which one? No. I think that I really think the poem that Jerry was citing was a cheap shot. I loved taking it, and it felt good. I think I've probably matured. I'm hoping I have, but we never know.
It's almost not fair because writers always do get the last word.
Well, it's troublesome,
Yeah.
Yeah, it's troublesome.
We have one right here. Could you stand up?
As a fledgling writer, when do you know to move it from the friends and family who are very supportive, obviously?
Yeah.
And now we've moved into a writing group and we still are getting a lot of positive encouragement, but when do you go beyond that? And what do you feel about writing groups?
What a good question. I want to have a go, Jerry. Because we've worked with young writers a lot. Both of us have, and I think too. Our benefit. I mean, we only do it for selfish reasons.
Yeah. Well, to make that leap from a friendly writer's group, I think a writer's group is a great thing and very, very useful. And I've met a number of quite well-known writers who make their living as writers and yet remain in the same writing group that they started in. And it's wonderful. We need nurturing because when you get out into that bigger world it's cold and lonely and brutal, and you have to be prepared to not get any feedback, not to get for possibly years form rejection slips, which are a really cruel form of communication because it teaches you nothing. You don't know if the editor was having a bad day or if you should go back to another way to spend your time. So I would definitely encourage you to stay with this group, build your skills and your confidence, but keep making forays out, risk yourself. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to know you've got a place to come back to where you'll be appreciated and listened to, because you won't be listened to for a while, more than likely. It's very tough to break into publications for most of us.
So. In response to what you had to say, do you find that reading group or writing group keeps you real, keeps you grounded as to, mm-hmm. Ooh, Mr. Famous Writer, here he comes, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good point, because you don't want a writing group that's just going to, blow warm air up your skirt. You want friends who are honest with you. So, being grounded is crucial. You have to have that sense of the truth of things. I mean, if it's not working, you need to know. It isn't always easy to judge that, but it's really much more easy when you have six people agreeing that it isn't working.
I think writers are well advised to marry up, to marry their betters. And most of the very successful ones I know have partnered with people who will tell them what they don't want to hear. including, you know, when your mouth is, you know, filling up with feet, you know, they'll say, maybe you should reconsider that line or something like that. Yeah, so I'm gifted with a spouse like that. I you've said the same thing yourself.
Yeah.
I think it's very important. If you can get two or three readers who will read your work, and, but then you have to give as good as you get. You have to read theirs and comment and be just and risk hurt feelings. But most writers who do this, you know, are glad for whatever the response is. Good editors who tell you you can't say that or you can't do that or who are free with a red pen are heroes as far as I'm concerned. I think, I mean, my first editor was Gordon Lish, who is, was Ray Carver's editor, and much has gone on about that, but Gordon Lish read every word I wrote in a book of poems that he could have, he needed like another belly button, you know. But he took it seriously. So, no, I think it's very important for writers to have intimate readers, you know.
Thomas, could you read us a poem? Maybe we should close out here.
Let me close up with a poem, Doug. This is, I have to say, when I was, I think it was about 50 when it occurred to me that I might be mortal too, so I started marking every, the numbers are convincing on this, aren't they? You know, you think I would have thought of it earlier, but, so I started trying to mark every year with a sonnet to mark the passing of time, a 14-line poem about time's passage. But I don't know, the older we get, the less we seem to count, which accounts for this 15-line poem called, it was written some years ago now, Refusing at 52 to Write Sonnets. It came to him that he could nearly count how many June evenings he had left to him, in increments of 10, or say 11, thus 63, 74, 85. He couldn't see himself at 96, humanity's advances notwithstanding in health care, self help, or new age regimens, what with his habits and family history. The end, he thought, is nearer than you think. The future, thus confined to its contingencies, the present moment opens like a gift. The blooming month, the green week, the gray morning, the hour's routine, the minute's passing glance, all seem like godsends now. And what to make of this? At the end, the word that comes to us is thanks. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
That was Thomas Lynch talking with Jerry Dennis. Thomas Lynch's latest book is Whence and Whither, On Lives and Living. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.